Today, the whole lesson appointed to be read today is found in your bulletin, as I will be sharing a reflection on the first section. That's what I will read today. The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to St. Luke. Glory to you, Lord Christ. When the days drew near for Jesus to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of him. On their way, they entered a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him, but they did not receive him because his face was set towards Jerusalem. When his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. This is the gospel of our Lord. Praise to you, Lord Christ. Please be seated. Good morning.
Morning.
So what's the deal with the Samaritans and the Jews anyway? To understand the context of this lesson, we have to have a little bit of history of 700 years of enmity between the Samaritans and the Jews. The story really begins in 922. In 922 BCE, Solomon is building his grand temple in Jerusalem, and he conscripts labor from the northern tribes. After the temple is complete, Solomon decides he needs a standing army to protect his new city of Jerusalem and the temple, and conscripts these same workers to stay on permanently to live in Jerusalem. Civil war breaks out. At the end of that time, in 922, the kingdoms are divided. And so we have the northern kingdom of Israel in the north with their capital in Samaria, and the southern kingdom of Judah with their capital in Jerusalem. 200 years later, in 722, the Assyrians invade the north. They take Israel captive. They destroy the city of Samaria. They take much of the population into various parts of the Assyrian kingdom and disperse them throughout the kingdom and move in others, aliens, foreigners, into Israel. Over time, of course, what emerges is lots of intermarriage. When you hear people, perhaps you've heard the expression about the 10 lost tribes of Israel, they're not so much lost as they got intermarried with other people, So that's in around 722. And then in 587 in the south, in Judah, there is an invasion there. Under Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians invade the south. They destroy, raise to the ground the glorious temple of Solomon. People are taken into captivity, but it's not everybody. It's only the intelligentsia, the leaders, the aristocrats, the nobility, the artisans, the craftsmen, blacksmiths, the people of some talent are taken away into Babylon. But unlike the experience in the north, there is no intermarriage. They are placed in ghettos and are segregated. There they will remain for 50 years. Those of you of my generation, may, if you remember the musical Godspell, that wonderful song, "On the willows there, we hung up our lyres, because our captives there required of us a song. But how can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?" Many of the Psalms that have a theme of lament come out of this period of history known as the exile. 50 years later, in 537, the Persians defeat the Babylonians, and Cyrus, the king, allows the Judeans to go back and begin to rebuild their lives. Even gives them a little bit of money to build a modest temple in Jerusalem. In the Hebrew scriptures, for that reason, Cyrus is referred to as God's Messiah. God's Messiah. So they begin to try to rebuild their lives. And a delegation of Samaritans come down from the north and offer to help to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem and are viciously turned away. Why? Because they're not pure race. They are half-breeds. And their religion is suspect because it has been influenced by foreign customs. In 332, Alexander the Great takes captive Israel in the north, the northern kingdom, from the Assyrians. And 10 years later, in 323, Alexander the Great dies, and there is a period of relative freedom in the north. And so the Samaritans at that time rebuild their ancient cities. Shechem and Samaria are rebuilt, and they establish a temple on Mount Gerizim. And so now we have in Palestine two rival temples, one in the south on Mount Zion and one in the north in Samaria. Two rival temples, two peoples claiming to be the true worshipers of Yahweh. These folks are not going to get along well. Sometime between the year 6 and 9, Common Era CE, some Samaritans come down into the south, into the temple in Jerusalem, and at the Feast of the Passover, they go through the temple and strew bones throughout the temple, which brings the Passover celebration to a halt and disrupts the holiday. In the year 51 CE, there is a pilgrim, a Judean pilgrim, who is traveling through Samaria, stops in the town of Gema, and when they discover that he is a Judean, they kill him. In retaliation, some Judeans come up from the south. They massacre the whole village of Gema and burn it to the ground. This is in 51. The gospel was written around 80, so this is what's called headline news. So this is the backdrop of the enmity between the Samaritans and the Jews, a deep enmity. And so as we encounter this gospel story today, we see that Jesus has set his face to Jerusalem, which means he is steadfastly going to Jerusalem. And unlike most pilgrims, Galileans who would go all the way around Samaria, would go all the way through Perea to go down to the south, Jesus is going to go straight through the towns of the Samaritans and go south in a steadfast way to Jerusalem. And he sends two of his lieutenants, James and John, as advanced men to find a place for them to spend the night and get something to eat. And as James and John go into the Samaritan town, the Samaritans discover that they are, in fact, probably by their accents, not Samaritans, are in fact Galileans, and they turn them away. James and John are furious, and they go back and report to Jesus that they have been turned away, and they say, "Let us call down fire from heaven." Is it any wonder that James and John, their nicknames are the Sons of Thunder? These are quick-tempered guys, the Sons of Thunder. Let's call down fire from heaven on those damn Samaritans. And Jesus rebukes them. Jesus rebukes them. Jesus, in his interaction with the Samaritans, seems to be trying to reach beyond the enmity between these people to find another place, a place of reconciliation. A place of reconciliation. In 2 weeks, we will have a story that Jesus will tell about a Samaritan, and the Samaritan comes off really well. But Jesus is trying to find a sense of reconciliation. So the question is what is reconciliation? What do we mean when we talk about reconciliation? Well, I want to give you an example of what it ain't. This story goes back to 1996. I had been working for the bishop at the Cathedral Center and was called to be rector of a church in Santa Monica. I had, in the end of 1996, a month of nothing to do, Sundays off, a rare treat. And so I thought it would be fun to visit the other churches in the new community I would be moving to. And one of those churches was St. Monica's, the enormous Roman Catholic church in downtown Santa Monica. And I'm sitting there and sort of going through the service. And at communion time at the offertory, Monsignor Torkenson said this: "If you are not Roman Catholic, please do not offend us by coming forward for communion. The Holy Communion is a symbol of unity, and until the churches are unity, please, if you are a Roman Catholic, do not come forward. I felt like I'd been, you know, smacked in the face. And I thought, well, it is what it is. Some years later, there was a celebration, ecumenical celebration. It was the International Week of Christian Unity. And it was going to be held at the Roman Catholic Church at St. Monica's. And I was there, and a Baptist, and a Lutheran, and a Presbyterian. It was a diverse group. And as we're all sort of dressed up, ready to go into church, Monsignor Torgerson said, "We look forward to the day when you all will come back to Rome." And I said, well, that felt more like an absorption than reconciliation. Jesus has a conversation with a woman at a well in Samaria. They sit and have a wonderful and quite lengthy conversation. When you go home today, I encourage you to read it. It's in the fourth chapter of John. And in this conversation, he asked her for some water at the well, and the writer reminds us that Jews and Samaritans don't share drinking vessels. But nevertheless, she gives him a drink, and they have this great conversation. And then, at the end of the conversation, it goes here, unexpected places. She says, "Sir, I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." Remember the history? Jesus replies, "Woman, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. A time is coming and has now come when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. A time is coming and is now when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth." Jesus is going beyond difference, beyond tolerance, right, to a higher place, beyond difference, a place beyond difference. So what does that say to us who live in this pluralistic age? How do we relate to other religions in this most plural age in which we live? It's a tough question. We struggle with it. Marcus Borg, in his masterful book, The Heart of Christianity, uses an image. He says, imagine, thinking about their spiritual quest, that there's an enormous mountain. And in this enormous mountain, there people from many different cultures and religions trying to see God who is at the top of the mountain. And there are various roads going up the mountain, and one road is labeled Christian, and one is Judaism, and one is Islam, and one is Buddhism, and all the rest. And so you're making your way up this mountain. You're not even particularly aware that there are other roads, but you're making your way. And as you get up towards the top of the mountain, as you approach God, you discover that all these roads converge and become one. Because all of our distinctiveness begins to fall away when we draw near to the presence of God. Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me." What's Jesus saying in saying that? What Jesus is saying is that he is the way. What is the way? It's the way of the cross. What's the way of the cross? It's the way of crucifying the self, of the ego, the sort of selfish nature that has to drop away if we're going to come into God's presence. And so as we go closer to God, all of our distinctiveness that we cling to become a little less significant, a little less important. Now, I want to be clear. I am a Christian. I am a Christian because my parents were Christians and my grandparents were Christians. This is my family. You are my family. This is the place that speaks to me. This is the tradition that moves my heart and fulfills my life. This is my home. But in order to love my home, I don't need to denigrate anybody else's.